When I think about the practice of forgiveness, one experience that comes to mind is from when I was in seminary. I had stopped by the office of one of my professors to make what I thought was a fairly simple request that really barely affected him at all one way or the other. But I was shocked when he responded loudly and harshly, not only refusing to accommodate me, but also using the opportunity to express all the and tell me all the inadequacies he perceived in me as a student and as a human being. I was stunned and simply sat there until the yelling stopped, and he said that I could go. We were alone in his office, but the door was open, and his yelling was overheard, such that when I walked out of his office, the first two people I passed said, "What was that about?" I later learned from his graduate assistant, as I started kind of processing and relaying the story, that there were other incidences of this sort of unpredictable cruelty, which seemed more about his own issues than the issues at hand. This incident happened early in my senior year in seminary. Fortunately, his class was not a required course, and I would still be on track to have plenty of credits to graduate, even if I dropped his course. So I scheduled a meeting with the dean, registered a formal complaint in writing, and dropped the course. But to be frank, my impression was that the dean, who had previously shown himself, in my opinion, to be spineless in regard to previous injustices, probably never confronted the professor with this incident, and I suspect just took my letter and put it in the recycle bin. For anyone curious, however, I will add that this professor was ultimately denied tenure at the divinity school I attended, although some light Googling tells me that he is teaching today at a fairly prestigious high school, so I feel a little bad for potentially some of those students, that maybe he's worked through some of his issues in the meantime, having lost a quite more prestigious graduate school appointment. More important for our topic this morning is that after a few days of talking through the incident with friends, I thought I was over it, similar to some of what Carol was describing earlier. I had dropped the class, after all, and didn't foresee any reason that I ever needed to see him again, and there was certainly not going to be any time that I foresaw him having any kind of authority over me in the future. However, many months later, I was innocuously studying on the porch swing outside of the graduate school housing, and I saw him unexpectedly walk out of the apartments kind of in the distance. I don't know what he was doing in the student apartments. I did not ask. I hadn't seen him in a long time, and suddenly I felt my stomach twist into a knot. I thought, wow, I'm really still angry with him. Mentally, I thought the incident was behind me, but in reality, that wound, even from this small incident, and obviously things like marriages are much more complex, but even from the small incident, many months later, the wound was still there, just underneath the surface. This story is one of many I could share, and you can likely think of your own struggles around forgiveness, around unforgiveness, either offering or receiving, or the respective lack thereof. And when I reflect on the practice of forgiveness again, one of the first names that comes to mind is Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and his leadership, especially with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, in post-apartheid South Africa. Recently, Archbishop Tutu published the Book of Forgiving, co-authored with his daughter, Mpho Tutu, one of his daughters. More than a decade ago, Archbishop Tutu published another bestseller that you may have heard of called No Future Without Forgiveness. And in that book, he offers powerful testimony of his firsthand experience that the most life-giving way forward for South Africa, potentially the only way forward, was through a full disclosure of the atrocities that had been committed. He perceived that the only way to reconcile a divided nation, to move from dictatorship to democracy, was through truth-telling, because otherwise things were repressed, and then what happens when you repress things is they tend to come out in these perverted, unusual ways. I would assume, to put my seminary professor on the couch, that something he had been repressing was coming out in this weird and twisted way about me. In Tutu's words, if the nation had not chosen to practice forgiveness, our rage and our quest for revenge would have been our destruction. Extrapolating more broadly, he invites all of us to consider that the same dynamic, that there is no future without forgiveness, is as true for us individually as it is for us globally as a human society. At least part of what he means is that without forgiveness, we cannot ever move fully into the future because we are both consciously and unconsciously tying ourselves, binding ourselves to the past. Reflecting on his experience leading the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Tutu writes that from what he has seen, in his opinion and in his experience, there is nothing that cannot be forgiven, and there is no one undeserving of forgiveness. Nothing that can't be forgiven, and no one undeserving of forgiveness. I will confess that I am not quite as spiritually evolved as Archbishop Tutu. I'm not sure I quite completely agree with those unqualified statements about forgiveness. However, I will say at the same time that Archbishop Tutu, seeing all that he saw in apartheid South Africa, has a powerful position to make such claims out of his firsthand experience. I'll also hasten to add that forgiveness really is a practice, and in many ways it's similar to practicing the piano or practicing basketball or other things that we practice. You get better the more you practice. Sometimes advice people give around forgiveness is fake it till you make it. Act like you really forgive this person. You may find out someday that you've stumbled backward into actually forgiving them. And to use that piano or basketball analogy, the more times you practice a sonata or shooting free throws, the more that action, again, becomes an ingrained habit. Similarly, the more you practice forgiving, the more forgiving can become second nature. Along these lines, a recent powerful example in recent memory is after the 2006 Amish school shooting in Pennsylvania. Such a horrific incident, but the response of the Amish community, who has spent generations, centuries, inculcating the practice of forgiveness as a core value of their community, their response was to immediately go to reconcile with the family of the assassin, of the murderer, who they knew must also be in deep pain for what their child had done. The Amish would agree with Archbishop Tutu that there is nothing that cannot be forgiven, and there is no one undeserving of forgiveness. But both in the case of the Amish and in South Africa, that is an advanced post-PhD level of forgiveness. Again, cultivated in community with great intentionality and over time. You don't start at that level of forgiveness any more than a child could compete in the NBA or play a Rachmaninoff concerto after only a few lessons. That's not even something the child Mozart could do the first time he sat at a keyboard. More realistic for most of us may be the teaching I heard recently from the Buddhist teacher Noah Levine, who said, "I forgive you as much as I can in this moment. For any way that you have caused me harm, whether it was intentional or unintentional, whether it was through your speech, your action, or your thoughts, I offer you forgiveness." Because sometimes we say, Levine writes, we say, "I forgive you," but it's not true. So being able to say, "I forgive you as much as I can," or "I offer you as much forgiveness as is available in this present moment," that way there's some humility with it and some honesty. That's saying, I'm in the process of forgiveness. It's not something that I can yet do perfectly in this present moment. There's wisdom in that easier starting point for trying to be authentic and transparent about where you are in the practice of forgiveness. And although there are also times when we're not yet ready to even begin the practice of forgiveness in regard to a certain person or incident, at a certain point, refusing to forgive can be like drinking poison yourself and hoping the other person dies. And along the lines of practicing forgiveness as much for your mental and physical well-being as for the sake of the offender, there's a famous Zen tale that two monks were walking through the forest and they came upon a woman unable to cross a river. Seeing the need, one monk picked the woman up, carried her across, and set her down on the other side of the bank. Both monks proceeded on their way, but miles later it became evident that the second monk was highly disturbed and agitated. When the first monk inquired as to why, the second monk said he just couldn't understand why this first monk had violated his vows by, as a male monk, touching a woman. The first monk responded, "I put that woman down miles ago. Why are you still carrying her?" In other words, be wary if your choices are only creating more suffering for yourself without having any impact on the other person or the other group. It's also important to address some of the central objections to practicing forgiveness. Tutu is clear that what he means by the call to practice forgiveness, that it's not about becoming a doormat for further abuse. He writes further that the practice of forgiveness as he intends it is not about weakness. Often it's about deep personal maturity and strength. It's not a subversion of justice. There still may be things that need to happen to really make amends or to have justice. It's not about forgetting necessarily, and it's definitely not easy in most cases. And there well may again be serious consequences, legal or otherwise, for the offender, irrespective of whether one chooses to forgive them. Indeed, as we have seen, forgiveness is often not primarily even about the offender. It's about the spiritual process of the person who has been offended. In the Spirit, Tutu writes the following as a meditation about forgiveness. As you listen, see if there's a particular word or phrase or line that really resonates with you as you kind of reflect as you listen to this sermon about where you are in regard to the practice of forgiveness. Tutu writes, "I will forgive you. I will forgive you." The words are so small, but there is a universe hidden in them. When I forgive you, all those cords of resentment, pain, and sadness that had wrapped themselves around my heart will be gone. When I forgive you, you will no longer define me. You measured me and assessed me and decided that you could hurt me, that I didn't count. But I will forgive you because I do count. I do matter. I am bigger than the image you have of me. I am stronger. I am more beautiful. And I am infinitely more precious than you thought me to be. I will forgive you. And my forgiveness is not a gift that I am giving you. When I forgive you, my forgiveness will be a gift that gives itself to me. And if you're interested in experimenting with what it might feel like to practice and look like and feel like to practice forgiveness in your life, Tutu recommends what he calls the fourfold path of forgiveness: telling the story, naming the hurt, granting forgiveness, and then renewing or releasing the relationship. I particularly appreciate his formulation of that fourth and final step, that practicing forgiveness does not have to entail renewing the relationship. Instead, authentic forgiveness can also mean releasing the relationship. For instance, I will say freely that I have zero interest in renewing a relationship with that professor that I described to you early. There are 7+ billion people on this planet, many of whom are interested in religion and philosophy and music and film and the things that I'm interested in. I don't need him to be my friend. But it was helpful for me to be more intentional about releasing the relationship when I realized that months later, I was still carrying around both anger and sadness about his cruelty. Now, forgiveness is a try-this-at-home activity, but it's not necessarily one, depending on your relationship and the degree of what happened, it's not necessarily one you want to first necessarily try with the person who you are not in right relationship with. It may be that you first want to start journal writing or writing a letter to the person that maybe you don't even mail. It may be that you need to work through this with a therapist or some other surrogate, like a best friend. For those of you who have walked our labyrinth or are curious about that practice, we have a Chartres-style labyrinth in between the sanctuary and the chapel. A way to use the labyrinth to practice forgiveness is that when you come, so the labyrinth, there's not a minotaur at the center, we're all clear about that, right? Okay. The labyrinth is what's called a unicursal pattern, so there's one way in and one way out. It's a structure that you can do walking meditation. So a way to practice forgiveness with our labyrinth, which is there open anytime because it's in the grass, is when you're standing at that entrance to the chapel, which is with your back to the Blanchains Art Gallery, start then by telling the story. Kind of set your intentionality that as you walk the labyrinth, you are going to tell and rehearse that story in your mind of what happened and tell it in a way that your heart is kind of open in compassion. And then as you walk into the labyrinth, that circular path into the center, you would do the second part, that is naming the hurt. So you would name the hurt and really be present to that. And when you finally get to the center, the practice would be to sit down or to stand there and to see, open your heart to practicing forgiveness and sort of, as Noah Levine said, to what extent in that present moment are you able to grant forgiveness? And then on the way, that circular path back out, tracing your steps that you came in, the invitation would be to see where you are as far as being able to renew or release that relationship. And then, as always, both I think it's important to pause before you pass the threshold into the labyrinth. You can also pause right before you pass that threshold out of the labyrinth to see what do you want to name intentionally that you're trying to integrate back into your life and living. Expanding our view more broadly, Tutu writes that practicing forgiveness, both individually and societally, is about breaking what he calls the revenge cycle. In order to have a chance of moving forward, to break that ongoing revenge cycle, to have a chance of moving toward healing and toward wholeness. In the revenge cycle, we choose to respond to hurt, to harm, to loss and pain with revenge, retaliation, and payback. But what that risks is others continuing the cycle by then just in turn hurting us further because they were obviously unjust in doing it in the first place. So what makes you think they wouldn't just continue the cycle rather than to say, okay, fair's fair, I hurt you, then you hurt me. That won't necessarily happen. As Gandhi said, an eye leaves the whole world blind. For Tutu, the biggest factor that allows the revenge cycle to perpetuate without end is rejecting our shared humanity with every other human being. Tutu practices what he calls, his worldview, he calls Ubuntu, and it's sort of that I am only me because you are. That is very relational. It's sort of where our first principle of the inherent worth and dignity of every person meets our seventh principle, the interdependent web of all existence. That's sort of Ubuntu, and that's where he sees forgiveness as so centrally important. And so rejecting our shared humanity, that means refusing or being unable to see, because of legitimate pain, the wounds, the brokenness, and the pain of the other person. In the case of the professor I shared with you earlier, I did consider retaliation, such as maybe right because I figured that the dean wouldn't do anything. I considered maybe I should just write a letter to the whole, you know, email and copy the whole seminary community with this story, especially as I started hearing other stories of other people, though I did encourage them to also go to the dean so that my record wouldn't be the first time and there'd sort of be a pattern. In response, I have no idea what payback, if I had done that, I don't know what response, what payback he may have enacted on me. But with some distance and time, I was eventually able to see our shared humanity. I'll likely never know for sure, but I have to assume from what I know about the human condition that there was some underlying cause for him lashing out at me in such a disproportionate way. Perhaps he had just been criticized by someone with authority over him or received some very disappointing news or had been dressed down by a superior just moments before I walked in the door or earlier in the day that he was still stewing about. And perhaps my presence gave him an excuse as someone that he had authority over to try to make himself feel better, at least in the short run, by belittling me. I'm sure none of you have had any sort of experience like this with authority figures or totally can't relate. Tutu writes, we can't create a world without pain or loss or conflict or hurt feelings, but we can work to create a world of forgiveness. But ultimately, no one can tell you to forgive. We can invite you on the journey. We can show you what has worked for ourselves and for others. We can tell you that the healing we have seen from those who have walked the fourfold path is a humbling and transformative one. But all of us must ultimately walk our own paths at our own pace. But in the end, the forgiveness you seek, whether it is for yourself or another, it's carried in your heart. You just need to look inside and discover it, Tutu writes. Discover the power that it has, the power that changing your heart has to change your life and to change our world. For the coming days and weeks, do you feel any prompting in your heart this morning to experiment with forgiveness, to tell your story, to name the hurt, to grant forgiveness, and to discern whether to renew or release the relationship? What might it feel like to say aloud, maybe just at first to a trusted friend, or in a journal, or in a letter that you may not even mail, or maybe just only in your heart regarding someone who has hurt you, "I forgive you as much as I can in this present moment for any way that you have caused me harm, whether it was intentional or unintentional, whether it was through your speech, your action, or even your thoughts. I offer you forgiveness as much as I can in this present moment."